Well, my name is Dan Dix. I'm the owner and operator of Press for Truth at pressfortruth.ca. And I've been involved with researching topics of the New World Order and these types of things for quite a long time now, around 10 years or so. And with the film, it was two gentlemen from White Buffalo Films, Stephen Davies and Jacob Krutachewil, who actually took the initiative to get the project started. And then I kind of slowly became more and more and more involved with the film. So eventually we were like, yeah, we're all kind of working together on this one. So that's kind of how the Nation's Deathbed started with the three of us. And then from there, it just progressed on to where we are now.
The Nation's Deathbed. What does that mean? It sounds pretty dramatic, that
right.
The Nation's Deathbed. So can you expand on what that title means and what it's supposed to evoke?
Well, it's pretty straightforward, and that's essentially what we're trying to convey is happening, that this nation, Canada, is literally on the brink of extinction. That's why we chose the Nation's Deathbed. Because that's really the issues that we're faced with. That's where things are heading. So we felt it to be a fitting title. Plus, it's kind of catchy, and you know, people seem to like death these days. But
well, you're talking about that the nation is on its deathbed,
right?
And when you talk about that, we're talking about issues such as the Security and Prosperity Partnership, right. The North American Union. Can you give an overview of what these things are? Obviously, a lot of our listeners already have some inkling of what's going on, but there are always new listeners who aren't entirely sure. They've never heard of these things before. So, from your POV point of view, what is the SPP, and is the North American Union a threat?
Right. So first of all, you have to be aware that there is an agenda generally for a new world order. Maybe a lot of the listeners have heard that term before. But really, the agenda is an ancient plan that is really essentially about uniting everything together into one world government, one world cash system, one world religion. So in order to accomplish these goals that they have, especially with one world government, things need to be merged into fewer and fewer hands. So the SPP and NAFTA and the North American Union plan is just really another step towards this goal of a one world government. Because when you want everything united into one, you have to slowly put together the pieces of the puzzle. And the North American Union is certainly one of the big chunks that they're working on putting together. It's similar to the same thing they did with the European Union, which was really not that long ago. It was set in place maybe 8 or 9 years ago, something like that. But it's the same kind of plans to unite governments into fewer and fewer hands. Essentially, it's a centralization of power into fewer hands. And now Canadians are faced with that scenario where our governments is being merged into fewer hands.
How did you become aware of this, and why did you decide to get involved in exposing these kinds of secretive plans? Because a lot of people, they hear about this and they think, yeah, Hey, it's a conspiracy theory. There's no way that could be happening. What convinced you that it's really that these plans exist, that they are being carried out, and that you're one of the people that decided to fight it?
Well, really, it started with me a long time ago, just looking into some of these topics. It started with me back in 1998. A friend of mine told me about chemtrails, which is, chemical trails as opposed to condensation trails that airplanes are leaving. And at first, I was like, no, this can't be. That's ridiculous. And, the government wouldn't do something like that. And, do you realize how big of an operation that would be? And I just didn't buy it. But then I started to actually look into it for myself, probably to try to disprove my friend, but I started looking into it, and I just started finding facts about it, and my mind was open to the possibility. So from there, my research just expanded into all these other areas, and I started studying all, secret societies and world religions and the occult and all these different things. And you can really only do so much research for so long until you start to think, well, I should do something about this. So I just had a feeling that I felt that I should be doing something. So I started out with just burning DVDs, handing out copies of DVDs, and then that turned into writing articles, and then I started joining different truth groups like 9/11 Truth and different groups like that, and then it just kept growing. And the more I started getting involved, the more I wanted to expose the agenda that I started to see unfolding.
And we'll come back to how people can go about exposing those agendas and raising the awareness of other people later on. Let's talk for a little bit about the things directly discussed in the film. Mm-hmm. That is the SVP, the NAU, the protest in Montebello, and the surveillance that surrounded the lead up and during it. There's a scene about halfway through the film where you and was it your brother?
Yep.
Yeah, you and your brother traveled to Ottawa and Montebello to get video of the demonstrations and what surrounded it. And there's an unnerving scene where you are asked by police to stop filming, and then they ask you for ID.
Mm-hmm.
So the question then becomes, is this something you've regularly experienced since then? And how many other people have you run into that have been basically asked, show your paper, citizen?
Yeah, that wasn't a first for me. I ran into that exact scenario when I went to the Bilderberg conference in Ottawa back in 2006, where I was merely just observing what was going on, and an officer pulled up and said, yeah, we need to see your ID. And I said, well, we're not doing anything wrong. And essentially, we didn't end up giving him our name or ID either. But yeah, in Ottawa, again, that happened. He said, you know, you guys, you know, no taping. You're not allowed to tape. And I know that, you know, we're standing on a sidewalk at that point, and it's completely, you know, in my rights to be filming. And I had already noticed cameras from the police filming us all throughout the day. So I was just thinking to myself, well, no, I don't really need to feel that I need to show you my ID. I mean, this isn't Russia or this isn't China. I shouldn't have to present my papers, like you say, just for walking down the street and, you know, filming government activity, really. So, yeah, I felt I, you know, didn't need to do that. So that's the position I took and stuck to it.
Let's talk a little bit about the North American Union itself and how it seems to be developing. It's every time one of these things comes up, a plan like NAFTA or FTAA, SPP, the people promoting it go on and on about how this is eliminating tariffs, eliminating borders, eliminating barriers, all kinds of supposedly eliminating the free flow of this, that, and the other thing. And yet, the borders are still there. It gets more and more difficult to cross the borders unless you get your papers, your ID card, where they have this thing called the Nexus card now. So the question, you know, that... Like, what's her name? Diane Richardson, I believe, is her name? Diane Richardson. Yeah. She talks about the elimination of internal barriers while this big external barrier, this Fortress North America, is being constructed. And yet we know that the borders are still there, that we're required to show our citizenship in a particular country, that people who travel looking for better work who end up getting worse work are considered illegal, and there's never any talk about making them citizens or giving them the right to decent wages, to good labor conditions. It's all about, oh, well, let's make them guest workers, let's make them less than a citizen. So my question, you know, then becomes, is part of the plan perhaps using the Soviet model of having an internal passport, having your papers that tie you to a particular location, to a particular section of this North American Union? And why would anyone want, not only want to live in that, but want to do that? Why not just wipe out the borders as a whole and let people travel freely?
Right. Well, they realize that some of these agendas that they're going for, the people are just all out going to reject and realize, no, we don't want that. We're not cool with that. So they realized a long time ago that you have to do it through small stages. It's conditioning, essentially. And through various means of propaganda, you know, through the media and education system and television and everything. And you basically manipulate their minds into believing that this is a good thing. And often a lot of the mechanisms that they use to manipulate the overall consciousness of the people to make it think that this is good... is sometimes order out of chaos is what they believe in. They believe if you can cause enough problems, enough pain and hate and suffering and this and that, then out of the ashes of such a problem, will emerge their solution, and their solution will be, yes, that we unite with America and Mexico, and we have the open border policy, and but you still need your national ID card in order to travel. And that's essentially the steps that they're taking to condition us to accept such a thing.
Is there going to be a move eventually, do you think, toward a single government for all three regions? Or will there be a facade of separate governments, but all working under the framework of these contracts, as one of the people in the film described them? Effectively, these contracts that very few people have tied $500 million to. Like, will there be one overall structure, do you think, developed? Or will there simply be a tendency between the power elites in these separate countries to maintain these contracts and this level of control?
Well, certainly at first, but I think they're going for what you mentioned there, that, yeah, essentially it will be one, not necessarily one ruler or one person, but yes, one governmental body controlling all three of the nations, essentially. I mean, Canada will still exist, but it will be under the rule of one body, one group of people ruling all three, essentially. Yeah.
And we see something like this developing in the European Union now. Mm-hmm. There's a European Parliament and a Council of Europe that effectively makes rules with no legislative oversight, no opportunity to for the however many million, hundreds of millions of people in Europe to counteract them, to deal with them effectively. We see similar structures starting to develop around other parts of the world.
Right.
The push for an African Union, for example. The push, I'm sure at some point there'll be a push for an Asian Union.
Mm-hmm.
And, the push is usually driven by the most economically powerful governments
mm-hmm.
in these countries. So why would any country that is not, among the considered the top tier, a country that, in Canada might be considered to have not province, for example, mm-hmm. why would they agree to a system where they're going to have to give away control of their resources,
yeah.
control the ability to institute stricter regulations, or maybe better, more environmental or better environmental law, better labor law, that their society may want.
Mm-hmm.
Why would they give away the right to do these things? What are they going to get in return for joining up with these power structures?
Right. Yeah. Like I said, maybe for lack of a better term, they will be tricked into it. As they look at it right now, they would think, no, this doesn't make sense to me. I don't want to be a part of that. I'd lose my sovereignty. We'd lose our right to rule. And, we don't want anything to do with that. And the elite understand this is the mentality of the people, but they've learned how to manipulate that and turn it around. And unfortunately, a lot of that comes through an attack, per se. And it doesn't necessarily have to be any kind of a terrorist attack. It could be some sort of an economic crisis or a health pandemic or anything to get the people into fear. That's the first step, afraid. And then you offer the solution, which is, look, we need to band together. We need to join together. This is for your safety. So basically, they'll be manipulated around to begin to think that this is a good idea, and maybe even to the point where they'll demand such a thing that, they can turn it around to the point where they'll demand to have these kind of restrictions set in place, really.
Or a lack of restrictions.
Yeah.
Because a lot of things that go into these agreements are the right for any corporation or any concentration of capital to demand that a particular regulation be struck or be relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
There's an infamous case, I believe, where a company in British Columbia, for example, forced a Mexican community to allow the construction of a facility that would spew loads of toxic chemicals under what's called a Chapter 11 move, where basically an unelected court
mm-hmm.
decided that this BC company could do whatever they want. But don't the people running these companies, don't the people sitting in these houses of parliament and the legislatures, working with these lobbyists, don't they have to drink the same water, breathe the same air, live on the same planet as the people that they otherwise don't care about? Why would they want to worsen things? Do you think that maybe they intend to take all the good stuff for themselves as well? How are they going to pull that off?
Well, sometimes it's hard to understand, because some people think it's all about money, some people think it's all about power. But what's important to understand is for the real global elite who are really running things, they already have all the money, they already have all the power. So it's a bigger agenda than that. It's literally demonically driven. So it's beyond money and power. So I've gotten that question before when, because there's an agenda to eliminate 80% of the world's population. Now people have asked me, now why would they want to do that? Wouldn't they want to keep people around so you can control them, manipulate them, make money off them? And it's a valuable question, but the reality is, it's beyond money, it's beyond power, and these guys are being driven from something beyond money and power. So,
the ultimate alpha males and females, perhaps.
Well, essentially, yeah, basically.
It's a frightening, the kind of frightening tendency that George Orwell laid out in 1984. Was the man just documenting his time, or was he like a prophet?
Well, yeah, that's a good question, because he seemed to really nail it. I mean, that book, he was bang on, you know, off by a few years, but he certainly seemed to have a pretty good idea of what was going on or how things were going to come about.
So the people that, you know, create these structures and they create these power structures, these structures of manipulation, do they think they can evade the consequences of what they're creating forever? I mean, yeah, they can manipulate people within their lifetimes. They can create, you know, controlled media structures, structures that run off doublethink, that define the discourse. They can, you know, they can even go as far as they want to try to divert as many resources under their control as possible. Mm-hmm. But I mean, ultimately, there has to be some kind of reaction, either among the populace, among a faction of the elite, even from the planet we live on itself. I mean, you can only pump so much crap into the water before it catches fire, like a river running through Cleveland, Ohio. Do they really? And I guess this is kind of asking your opinion. Do they really think they can get away with this?
Well,
forever?
Yeah, I think they themselves are deceived. they truly believe that we deserve to be controlled and manipulated. They essentially feel that they are gods who have a divine right to rule over the rest of mankind. It's been no different with any civilization. You look into the past, whether it's the Babylonians or the Egyptians or, you know, the Alexander the Great, you know, the Romans, all of these civilizations have had people who have wanted to rule and power and control the rest of the world and all of the population. So it's really no different now. So yes, they essentially feel that they are unstoppable and that there won't necessarily be any consequences for their actions. And a lot of them realize that they won't necessarily see the finished plan in their lifetime, but they're still proud to be a part of it all. And a lot of the times they realize, you know, the agenda will be carried on through their children, through the bloodlines that have been running down for thousands of years. The agenda continues on from their kids to their kids to their kids.
Now, there's a strong element in what you're describing of, on the part of the people carrying this out, a strong element of class, even a caste structure,
yeah,
of perhaps some degree of eugenicism.
Mm-hmm.
They may not be necessarily engineering themselves, but they think they are of better blood, perhaps.
Right.
A strong element of the, you know, the idea that they have the right to manipulate it, and they are the Brahmins. They are the top of the structure.
Mm-hmm.
Are there people from the inside that are exposing this kind of thing? Are there people who, you know, are effectively, I guess Marx would call them class traitors, traitors to their class,
mm-hmm,
who are doing work to expose this idea, to try to stop it from happening, because they know what it will lead to?
Yeah, there has been pretty key whistleblowers. A big reason why we are now familiar with the Bilderberg Group is because of a man named Jim Tucker, who's been following them for over 30 years, and he's been getting contact from an insider, somebody who sees the agenda and sees the wicked ways behind what they're doing and wants no part of it. So what this guy's been doing is leaking information to Jim Tucker about where the meetings will be and when and what will be on the agenda. So yeah, it is good to know that there is some good in this upper levels of power. There still seems to be you know, some hope, some good guys lingering in there. I don't think everybody involved in, say, the CFR or Bilderberg or Trilateral Commission or these kind of groups are necessarily all evil and hell-bent on world domination. In fact, a lot of these guys who are really running the things believe that what they are doing is a good thing. They don't think it's wrong. You mentioned eugenics, like Hitler was a eugenicist. I feel that when he was murdering all the Jewish people, he truly believed that it was a good thing. He thought he was going to make the world a better place, for generations to come. I think he truly believed that what he was doing is a good thing. So a lot of these guys are deceived and manipulated into believing that what they are doing is for the better of the world.
Yeah, I guess, you know, when you talk about these kind of things, people immediately think you're talking about people in dark, dank, smoky rooms,
right,
rubbing their hands together, yeah, and cackling like Dick Cheney.
Yeah.
When you hear these people speak about what they're doing, they're talking about these grandiose terms, as if they are saving the future of the world, preserving the future, creating a better future,
right,
which oddly enough sounds like a lot of the bunk that, yes, Hitler spewed, a lot of the bunk that you hear from various religious fundamentalists and cultists.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it is very much the kind of thing you hear from, people who run ostensibly reputable countries, ostensibly reputable organizations. I guess my question is it conspiracy or tendency? Like, is the drive to control the rest of the population, yes, there are plans out there. Yes, there are plans that have been developed. But is it, is it conspiracy between people who actively discuss this, or is it the tendency of people who have been born into certain places, who have manipulated their way into certain, degrees of power, to believe that they have the right to do these things? And it's, no one wants to ruin the party, so they have to carry it on.
Yeah, certainly I'd lean more towards tendency for sure. Because when you start to look into the hierarchy of the global elite, and you look into where do they get their information from, and you find out that it turns out that most of these guys are into the occult, highly, deeply into the occult, and they revel in spirit communication is what they get involved with. So that's where a lot of these guys' information comes from. So they feel that they're tapping into something that is huge and is important and is really an amazing thing that they've tapped into here. But I feel that they themselves are being manipulated and deceived, essentially by the spirit world to rule the rest of the world, essentially.
All that stuff about the divine right of kings coming back in another form, effectively.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the deception comes that they are led to believe that they are like gods. So again, they truly feel that they have the divine right to rule the rest of everyone else.
One of the things mentioned early in the film, and something that has come up before in Canadian politics, and indeed it's kind of a running issue, is water. We're sitting on loads of fresh water, mm-hmm, probably one of the last major reserves in the world, because we know what humanity has done to the rest of the planet and mm-hmm, this part of the planet. And one thing that keeps coming up is a desire by primarily from the United States to get fresh water shipments, get control of the Great Lakes, the Great Lakes diversion to the Ogallala Aquifer, various other water diversion projects. Because if you look at the status of things like the Colorado River, other major watersheds, they have been emptied by uncontrolled, although to some degree controlled, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
I guess careless development, careless draining and abuse of these resources. And there's always a push for the Canadian government at the time to agree to the diversion of water without any way to take it back. And one of the people interviewed in the film talk about the idea of proportional sharing.
Mm-hmm.
That is that, whatever percentage of the water resources we have available, we always have to hand over proportion to
right,
the United States. Why in hell would anyone sitting in Ottawa ever even entertain an idea like this? Like, again, what is in it for them, and why would they want to lock future generations into a system where they no longer have, where even they no longer have control over the resources.
I think a lot of them are not even aware of these kinds of provisions in the agreement, like the NAFTA, where that proportional sharing clause is in. Is you know, I wouldn't be surprised if many of the people pulling the strings haven't actually read it. You know what I mean? So they're probably not going to be aware of such a thing until basically it's too late, until it's to the point where you essentially just have to approve what they've already done.
And has this kind of thing been repeated in other supranational structures like the EU? I know people constantly worried about the UN pulling a stunt like this, or in other economic groupings like what's the one in Asia? ASEAN, the Asian Security and Economic Assistance Net, whatever it's called.
Yeah.
Has there been a pattern of the more powerful countries and the more resource hungry countries demanding the resources of their neighbors, and their neighbors actually agreeing to this kind of thing?
Well, that's certainly what seems to be starting to emerge in our time. I mean, we see what's going on with oil, certainly, and all the problems that are going on with that, and the desire to gain control of the world's oil. So yeah, the next biggest thing to that, or bigger, I would say, is fresh water. So logically, for them, they have to continue what they're doing and shift it on to fresh water. And then yeah, we Canadians, I mean, we got the largest freshwater lakes in the world, and they understand that, they know that. But what they don't understand is that we are a nation that is filled with proud patriots who really love this country. And I feel that people will take a stand when they start to become aware of these kinds of agendas. So this thing is still beatable, but awareness is key at this point.
Now, one of the things that has to be installed along with any kind of supranational overarching power structure, any hierarchy, basically needs its lackeys. It needs its eyes and ears and systems of control. And you've been at the receiving end of some of it, mm-hmm. like that incident in Ottawa where you were basically asked, "Where's your paper, citizen?"
Yeah.
But one problem that, at least one thing that's presumably a problem, is that the lackeys need to be controlled as well. You need enough people who've been indoctrinated to be able mm-hmm. to maintain that structure. And the question is that kind of thing sustainable effectively forever? Because that's how long these things would need to stay in place for right. their plan to be effective. I mean, we saw these systems collapse in the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. East Germany is a prime example, where one out of every 10 people was effectively an informant. That didn't last forever.
Yeah, yeah. It's referred to as compartmentalization, where it's set up in a pyramid structure, where you really only need the guy at the top to have an awareness of the true agenda. But that's all that is necessary to be involved. And that guy being the top of his organization, whether it be police or healthcare or politics or secret societies or whatever, his ideas will permeate down throughout the rest of the organization. So all these people, they don't necessarily are not minions, or they're not aware of the overall agenda, but they are unwitting dupes. You know, they're pawns in the game. But again, when you realize it's set up in a pyramid structure, like you said, these things come crashing down, and people need to realize it is us who make up the base. You know, we make up the base of this system that is able to sustain itself. So in order for a crash to happen, you just need enough people to be aware. It's like the bottom brick, you know, is enough people to step out to essentially cause the crash.
We see that structure being put in place with things like the border agreements, the border security agreements that allow for greater more penetration into your personal effects when you cross the border, better, more tracking of where you go and whether you're allowed to go anywhere or not, with things like the watch lists, the no-fly lists in the U.S. and Canada, in other parts of the world. And yeah, ultimately at the top, there's a few people. And even then, though, they would run into the problem of having these clashing personalities. What happens when you get these personality clashes? Or, you know, worse for them, they get a revolt from one sector of their structure that decides, you know, we're not benefiting from this enough. We want more. or, you know, even a mass revolt from the base.
Mm-hmm.
Do they have plans or ideas for how to deal with those kind of strong possibilities? Or do they simply think it won't happen to a degree that they'll have to worry about?
Well, I think that to a degree, certainly. They probably feel literally that you know, it's unstoppable and that they're too big and too powerful and probably are not too worried about it. But again, you know, people who don't look at history are doomed to repeat it. And I'm not saying they don't know their history, but when you look at it, these things are essentially just doomed for failure. I mean, there's always going to be a resistance to these things. There always has been, there always will be. And in this day and age, it seems like it's really, really growing. The truth movement, as you know, some people call it, there's a massive awakening happening. So that could be causing the elite to think that, you know what, we may have a potential problem here. It's crunch time. I think they may feel it's crunch time. It's time to kick it up a notch, because people are becoming aware more and more every day.
Indeed, in the film, there are a diverse array of voices expressing their opposition to things like the SPP,
yeah,
to the NAU. People from as far around the political spectrum and compass as Jack Layton of the NDP, mm-hmm, to members of the John Birch Society in,
right,
the United States, or organizations that normally you probably would never be able to find even in the same city.
Right.
Just talking to each other, never mind talking about their opposition to the same subject. So can you go a bit into, you know, the shared concerns of people across, you know, around the political compass about, you know, about what is wrong with the SBP and the NAU and everything that follows on from that?
Yeah, well, the fact is that it affects three countries, really. So people in America are certainly aware of what's going on. People in Mexico are beginning to wake up to this agenda. And certainly Canadians seem to be really becoming more and more aware of what's going on. So, yeah, there is a big awakening happening between all three countries. That's why we see, you know, we had the president of the John Birch Society in our film speaking out against it. We had, like you said, Jack Layton and Peter Julian from the NDP. We also have Connie Fogel of the Canadian Action Party. So all these different groups are trying to essentially say, look, we're faced with the problem and we need to get the word out. That press conference was awesome to have all those people together to talk about the issues together.
One thing that has been heavily discussed among activists and perhaps lamented among activists, especially in the wake of Montebello, was the lack of mainstream media concern at all. We've been complaining about the mainstream media for all of us for some time now, but it seemed that for a period, probably from the day that the Zapatista uprising started in 1994, up through sometime after the unfortunate, you know, the tragic day of 9/11, that these movements opposed to tying all of humanity to a contract drawn up by a few were being taken seriously. You know, they were driving the agenda, which was something that, you know, horrified the hell out of the elite. Suddenly the idea that, oh my God, these dirty lower class people are actually being taken seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that in the past few years, that's kind of been shoveled aside.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly it's back to being the realm of, oh, those wacky conspiracy theorists. Oh,
yeah,
you know, those wacky people in the streets and I've got mine, Jack, and, you know, we don't need to hear all of that. So the question,
right,
then becomes, what has proven effective in getting the word out about, you know, opposition to, you know, the further centralization of control, and what more can be done? Is there any hope for the mainstream media? You know, is it all up to alternative media and word of mouth? What has worked and what is going to work?
Yeah, I think there's certainly a new media and a new press arising. Certainly the internet, and a lot of times you get that, you know, well, you get your information from the internet, well, you're a conspiracy theorist. But people are beginning to realize that they're lied to every single day from mainstream media, so they're looking to other sources for information. And, you know, the internet's a great spot if you know where to look. You know, there's tons of garbage you have to sift through. But essentially, yeah, there's a new press emerging, and that is key, because I don't know if there's necessarily hope for the mainstream media, and maybe the focus for activists is to shift to alternative media and to start your own websites or blogs, and maybe start looking into those things instead of watching, you know, CNN every day.
That leads to another question. If the mainstream media is kind of hopeless for the moment, like we know that they're bought and sold, that they're controlled. Protests are often done purely to draw exposure, to draw eyeballs and ears. And is there perhaps an idea growing that perhaps protest has worn out, like public loud protest has kind of run its course for the time being, that we've done the protests, we've had the street parties, we've had Reclaim the Streets, and, you know, that's been kind of burned out as something effective. Is it time to maybe to move to other tactics, like, you know, forming local organizations, mutual aid organizations, local information networks, things that maybe aren't necessarily as loud and fun to do, but maybe longer lasting, maybe more effective in the long run, things that have, you know, worked in other revolutions and resistance movements?
Yeah, absolutely, certainly. There's so many things that can be done. Now, not to say that rallies and protests are completely ineffective, but really, you need the draw, you need the people, and the whole point of having a rally or a protest essentially is to get mainstream media coverage, because it's all about awareness. So those things are, I feel, they're still effective, they're still good, but it only really works if the media covers it, and it looks like nowadays they're not too interested in covering these sorts of things, and when they do, it'll be twisted. You know, like the coverage of Montebello, for instance. When I got back from that and I watched the footage and seen some of the news clips, I was blown away by CTV and Global and all their pure out lies. I mean, I was there. I saw how it all went down, and they made it look like the protesters were the aggressive ones, and that the police had no choice but to, you know, tear gas and rubber bullet us all. And they kind of portrayed that in the first couple days after it all went down.
At the same time as they're blowing it off as fizzle, that, you know, the repeating Harper's claim that only a couple hundred people showed up, and you and I were there.
Yeah.
We saw there were more than a couple of hundred people that that were at that action. And I know many of the locals even were saying, you know, what the heck are the police doing here?
Yeah.
This is a disproportionate response. And I think you folks, you know, should have the right to come out here and say these things to, you know, the three leaders that are just off in that chateau about half a click, you know, down the driveway. So it is pretty interesting to see the tactics of manipulation that take place. Did you get a sense of solidarity among all the people that were there? There were Council of Canadians, there were anarchists, you know, members of various parties, you know, people, you know, local, people, you know, involved in 9/11 truth, that kind of thing. Was there a sense of, were people talking with each other and trading information, or, you know, like, did it seem kind of disjointed, as if, you know, people were still, you know, not entirely sure how to handle the present situation?
Well, certainly the protest the day prior to the Montebello one in Ottawa, which was huge, and certainly everyone there was, you know, somewhat on the same page, and a lot of people doing some really good networking and talking with each other. And certainly that was the case the day before. And then the following day in Montebello, I think just the sheer police presence, just the look of the scenery, maybe changed the mindset of the people protesting and shifted, you know, them just doing a peaceful demonstration to being, hey, what's going on over there? There's 1,000 riot police up there. And so, I think on day one, the intentions were great and people were getting along just fine. And then day two, the focus shifted to, you know, the riot police.
Going to a question about the fact that our governments can lock us into this thing. We have presumably fairly elected governments, because we're told that representative democracy is as good as it gets. You know, this is the, you know, maybe what was H.L. Mencken's line? You know, it's a bad system, but it's 8 times better than anything else we have. So we have three, presumably elected governments. George W. Bush, you know, accepted for the moment. Let's put an asterisk by his name. Of three ostensibly liberal democracies with varying degrees of social democracy, but, you know, presumably they all, you know, they're all built on promises of freedom and the ability to express yourself, and that you have a voice in the government, and you mm-hmm. have control through your representative. We have these three representative democracies that are going to tie 500 million people into a contract. A treaty is effectively an international contract.
Mm-hmm.
Into a contract that those 500 million will have no ability to amend. No, they're being kept out of the debate.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be, they and their descendants will be stuck in that framework.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone they, you know, try to put into power afterward will be either be stuck with that framework, or those individuals will be already controlled.
Right.
They'll be, you know, already reaping the benefits of being involved with that power structure.
Yeah.
So the question, you know, then becomes, you know, is there a better system? Like, is there a way that we can organize our societies to resist this kind of mass control? Basically, can we reform our existing structures to try to make them better, more responsive? Is revolution the answer, perhaps? You know, ripping it all down and installing something presumably better.
Right. Yeah, there's certainly something needs to be done. I mean, people, I think, are beginning to aware that democracy itself is not necessarily a good thing. Democracy essentially is the illusion of choice. That's what people are given. It's the illusion of choice. The global elite realize that it's such an easily manipulatable mechanism, the idea of democracy, to manipulate the people into them thinking that they have an option and they have a choice. So certainly that whole system needs to be flipped upside down and turned around. Now, whether, you know, a revolution needs to take place or what needs to take place to bring that kind of a change about, I don't know. But certainly we cannot continue in the way that we are going at this point, that's for sure.
The film is full of a lot of rather insightful quotes, along with descriptions of rather disturbing incidents, like what one individual member of the Canadian Action Party was put through with government, with, you know, people from the mm-hmm. Ministry of Public Security.
Yeah.
And the fact that we have a ministry with that name. And,
yeah.
You know, once again, back to Orwell, members of the Ministry of Public Security showing up on her doorstep, you know, asking her to basically be an informer.
That's right.
You know, as if they don't, as she said, as if they don't already know what's going on. They probably know better than she is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, again, we have this structure, this tendency to, you know, look at everyone as guilty until proven innocent, as if the public is the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you let people know that they are being viewed as an opposition, that they are not viewed as valuable, that they are not, you know, viewed as really a citizen, or, you know, someone that, you know, that the government should be listening to, that their government fear, you know, views them as simply another resource to be controlled. How do you get that word out and have it, you know, stick in their brains?
You mean to the actual government agents, or?
Well, perhaps even to the government agents. They are human beings as well.
Right.
And, you know, human beings can be convinced, and, you know, people are, you know, for the most part, are willing to at least try to open their minds to certain things. So, you know, primarily people who aren't involved in the government, how do you go to them and, you know, inform them of these things and have that information actually reside in their heads,
mm-hmm.
And actually have an influence on them? And how do you get to the people who are within the system who might, you know, you might be able to pull out of that system to have them turn on it?
Well, everyone's different. In my experience, when it comes to trying to awaken people's minds and to try to tell them what's going on, everyone's different. You have to approach different people differently. Sometimes it might require you to just feel it out a little bit and talk to a certain person and then get a sense of how much can you begin to tell them about the corruption? Because it's when you're telling something to somebody that what they believe is not necessarily true, it requires an element of, you have to swallow your pride a little bit. And that's the problem with whether it be a government agent or any kind of citizen or whoever. When you're telling them what you believe is not necessarily the truth or not necessarily how it is, people get on the defensive naturally. And it requires people to swallow their pride and admit that maybe things aren't the way I necessarily thought they were. So it's tricky to get people out of that little comfort bubble that they're in. So it depends on the person. You really have to feel them out and figure out how much can I say here before I completely turn them off and they think I'm a wacko conspiracy nut. You know, you have to ease into certain things, for certainly.
Quote, a couple quotes from the movie describing what this is all leading to, and I want to get your response to them. Okay. NAFTA was merely the first draft of an economic constitution for North America. The SPP seeks to build on NAFTA.
Right.
Now, constitutions, you think basic law, you know, like everything print, you know, printed accessible for everyone to see, maybe a bit of legalese, but presume, you know, like we're talking about basic laws that everyone is tied to. And they're describing NAFTA as the first part of what's going to be a basic economic law,
mm-hmm.
Which will be promoted as free trade, but as, you know, someone in the film mentioned, is managed trade, very controlled trade.
Right.
What is your thought on the idea that, you know, an economic constitution is being drawn up and you're being told, you know, like when you talk about it, people are telling you, oh, it doesn't exist.
Right. Well, because a lot of the reasons why is because of their very wording of how they are presenting this. I mean, NAFTA, I mean, free trade, that sounds like a good thing. The SPP, you know, just the wording they use, security and prosperity, partnership, all these words sound like a good thing. So I guess essentially the people don't necessarily perceive a problem when you present it in a way that, well, this is good for free trade. You know, we all want trade. We want our economies to be stronger. Everyone wants security. Everyone wants prosperity. So maybe that's where some of the manipulation comes in with the key words that they use, where people just don't get it, you know.
Connie Fogel says something interesting, where she's talking about, you know, how she would prefer to see, you know, like a separate Canada and a U.S. and a Mexico, and, you know, right. we are different peoples. Vive la différence.
Mm-hmm.
Vive la différence. What does that say to you? What is that?
Well, I suppose what she's trying to convey is that it is important to remain sovereign, really. I think what she meant by that was, you know, nothing against the American people, nothing against the Mexican people. But like I said, we are proud Canadians. We love this country the way it is. Nothing to say anything wrong with those other places. But in the sense of vive la différence, you know, we like being who we are, and we don't want to merge with anyone. When she said that, though, it gave me chills. You know, when she says, you know, Canadians are different from people in America, and we're different from people in Canada, and vive la différence. Something like that just gets you pumped up to think that, yeah, you know what, we're a sovereign nation, and we have the right to rule and govern ourselves. And I think that's essentially what she meant by it, but certainly it was a pretty good soundbite.
If these things get rammed through and, you know, odds are one way or another, we're, you know, either as one big document or as a series of little documents split up to make it easier to swallow, these things may very well get rammed through. How do they get reverted? How do all of us, and there's a lot more of us than there are people sitting in the Capitol and the House of Commons and the equivalent in Mexico and Strasbourg, etc. Yeah. How do we all manage to revert that? Do we operate on a local level to get local governments to say, no, we're not going to follow that? Do we form extra governmental structures to say, no, we're not going to follow that? How do you resist? How do you turn it back?
Yeah, certainly all these things need to come into place, but the first and foremost thing is awareness. I mean, people, your average Canadian is just simply not aware of this kind of a plan or agenda yet. change will not happen unless there's enough people who realize that there's a problem in the first place. So I suppose, you know, the first thing that needs to be focused on, and that's why we made the film, it's all in the interest of getting the word out and getting Canadians to be aware that there's potentially a problem. And then from there, I mean, yeah, like you said, we have, you know, there's many, many more of us, you know, just like I said, in the pyramid structure, we make up the base. So we essentially have the power in this system. It's just a matter of us becoming aware of that fact. So that's why right now I'm mainly focused on awareness. That's our whole goal of making the film, is to just try to wake up the sleepy and try to Bring awareness to as many people as possible, because like I said, change won't happen unless there's enough people who know that there is a problem.
Have you had much response to the film as of yet?
Yeah, the response has been really good. I mean, people really, really like the film. Certainly within the movement, the truth movement. You know, we have people like Alex Jones who's been promoting the film. He's had our trailer on all of his websites, and we have other groups out there like Toronto Change, and certainly conspiracy culture is getting involved, and a lot of people, really, really good feedback from those kinds of people, but that's not necessarily our target market. We need to reach people who are not aware of it. So the feedback amongst the people who have already seen it, they think this is really well done, it's really well put together. But these are people who are already aware of the North American Union and the, New World Order agenda. So the feedback from these people have been great. But again, we need to bring this to a wider audience, for sure.
And how do you do that?
Well, you do it by doing things like I'm doing right now. We're just kind of doing everything we can to try to, we're set up certain distribution deals with an organization in the United States. We've gone into a couple stores now who are going to start selling our film, and just expand on getting the word out. I mean, doing more interviews and more. It's just all about. People need to be aware that this film exists, So, we're just doing all we can to try to get the word out.
Well, like I say, you're doing a marvelous job at doing that. The film is quite watchable. The film is The Nation's Deathbed, and I've been speaking with one of the executive producers and one of the people who keeps getting asked for his papers, Dan Dix. Dan, thank you for coming out today.
Yeah, thank you very much.